welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 29th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, and ahead of International Transgender Day of Visibility this weekend, Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Madison Edward Wright sits down with the former research director at Justice Trans, Alexis. The two discuss the reports, events, and plans Justice Trans is working on to help two-spirit trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming communities in Canada. Here are Alexis and Madison in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rabble Radio. Today, I'm sitting down with Alexis, the current, unfortunately, soon-to-be former research director for Justice Trans, an organization that was founded in 2015 to serve the two-spirit, trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming community, specifically to educate folks about their legal rights in Canada. And today, Alexis is here to speak with us. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alexis.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited to dig into this. I've been following Justice Trans for a little while and a lot of the organizing that you guys do. It is quite extensive. I was wondering, maybe to kick us off, you know, when people go onto the Justice Trans website, you can see quite a few pop-down tabs, and you do have a full section where it goes province by province and territory, explaining the legal rights that two-spirit, trans, non-binary, and gender non-conforming folks have in each province. Can you tell me why this was a really important thing for Justice Trans to collect in one spot?
This was the reason Justice Trans was founded. It started out as a legal information website before it became a nonprofit and now charity. And actually, speaking of the website and that legal information section, right now, Justice Trans has actually partnered with pro bono law students from Dalhousie University who reviewed and updated all the legal information. And so the website, the new website that with all the updated information will be launched in the coming months, I believe.
Okay.
So stay tuned for that. It will be up to date with all this information.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, so this event is coming up March 25th. It is titled Understanding and Fighting Back Against the Transphobic Movement in Canada. So, you know, can you tell me about the motivation behind creating this event, the importance of the title as well, and what your driving factors were in putting it all together?
So it is a project that is funded by Women and Gender Equality Canada, and it is all about identifying and countering the anti-trans movement here in so-called Canada, because there's a lot of work that is done internationally. But as we have seen in the past years, Canada is not immune, and it has gotten worse and worse with time. So that was why the project was thought out at first. And it started in, I believe, February 2023 and is wrapping up next week, actually, with the end of March 2024. So that is why the project was born, basically to have a systemically collected source of information about this, because so much is happening, it's hard to keep track and have a sense of what the anti-trans movement is, what it's doing, and how to fight back against it. So the event ultimately is part of the ways that we're disseminating this information to the community. So there is a guide that is currently getting finalized and will be launched in the next few months. So about a 20-page guide, I would say, that explains all of our results and how to fight back, basically, and protect ourselves and our community. Mm-hmm. There will also be videos coming up, so stay tuned.
Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of the event? So unfortunately, at the time of this recording, we're doing it before the event takes place. But right now in the docket, you've got quite a few activities lined up, an information session, a sharing session as well. Can you tell us why, when, what kind of thought went into breaking the day up in that way and what your intentions are with each segment?
Absolutely. So the opening and closing will be done by Two Spirit elders. As a reformed academic, I have been to so many conferences that are so dry and that are just about, here is pretty traumatic content, and we will not take care of people in any way in presenting this information. So that's kind of the thought process behind this. Opening and closing with ceremony is a way to ground ourselves and to also align with how Justice Trans wants to do things, which is to engage in decolonial ways of doing things. There will also be a presentation about the results, as well as a roundtable on lessons learned from this project. There will be artistic performances by 5 artists, and there will also be a healing circle facilitated by Two Spirit elders. So this is also a way to take care of the community, because as we found out throughout this research project, everyone is feeling the effects of the anti-trans movement, even people who weren't directly attacked. So it's important to take care of ourselves.
Absolutely, especially when you're going over numbers and facts that are harmful, like you mentioned. And that is actually one of my follow-up questions for you at Justice Trans. What do, as members of Justice Trans employees, to protect yourselves as well and take care of yourselves?
One of the really important things that we have done throughout the year within the research team is to have meetings every week, not only to talk about tasks, but to debrief, especially around the research interviews that we did that were really difficult. And also, like the broader community, I don't know how familiar the audience will be with this, but within the trans, two-spirit, non-binary, and gender diverse community, there's an overrepresentation of disabled people. And that is absolutely the case at Justice Trans as well as staff. And so accessibility, and beyond accessibility, disability justice is a really important way that we try to do this work and engage with this work. I would say, though, as prepared as I thought I was to do this work, as someone whose research in general is always about traumatic content, I was not prepared for how difficult it would be to be an all-trans team dealing with this on a personal level, as well as dealing with this on a professional level. It has been extremely difficult on everyone on the team, despite all the precautions we have taken. So definitely self-care is really important, and it has also come up in the research interviews as well as things people do after being attacked by the anti-trans movement. It is a protective strategy to mitigate harms. Another way is just to, I think a really important way actually is being really strategic about visibility of people at the organization. And I think that's a lesson for other orgs as well. Unfortunately, in these times, it's not safe to have, I feel it's not safe to have like staff pictures and names up on the website and that kind of thing. So even though a lot of community orgs want to be accountable to community, it's not the best time to have your name up everywhere. So I personally am really strategic about that. Other people evaluate the risk differently, but doing this research has absolutely been a lesson for me as well with how bad it can get, unfortunately.
And I think, you know, the trend in laws that we've seen passed in the U.S. in the past few years is absolutely horrific. I think it's really important for people to remember that we're also seeing that reflected in Canada and that we're not isolated from it. You know, in October 2023, we saw the nationwide counter protests to the 1 million march for children. That was really powerful. And we saw people rally together and call out that kind of rhetoric. But it hasn't stopped more comments coming through. You know, we've seen politicians like Pierre Poilievre, some of the top political leaders in our country, adopting very hateful and harmful attitudes towards trans folks and the 2SLGBTQ community. So how has this event, understanding and fighting back against the transphobic movement in so-called Canada, helped, if it has, you and your team understand and navigate the realities of where we are as a country right now in terms of protecting and not protecting
I think all of us are and would have been extremely aware of how bad it is currently without doing this project. However, doing this project has meant we can't look away because we need to document and track. And it's not only politicians who are taking up the anti-trans movement and being part of it, it's also political parties pushing and passing anti-trans laws in multiple provinces right now. So that is something that's very scary for the community, and that I think a lot of people who aren't trans don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, jumping back a little bit. So I don't know if you were with Justice Trans at the time, so you can totally cut me off if this is too far back of a jump. I went through the Two-Spirit Trans Non-Binary Gender Nonconforming Perspectives on Access to Justice, a Legal Needs Assessment. And my understanding that that was almost the precursor study released to the one that will be following the event on March 25th. Were you involved in the creation of that?
No, I was hired specifically for this project. And the Access to Justice project was finished when I came on. I have glanced at the report, but I am not engaged in it meaningfully enough to answer questions. But it is a really important resource, and I would recommend people to check it out. There's a full report, but there's also a zine, like a short form zine, available in French and in English. And our social media also has a bunch of slides that kind of summarize results from that report.
Some of the statistics and the results of that study, despite us being 2 years later, still hold quite true. Some of the ones that pop up on the website, you know, they talk about 73% of respondents report harassment due to their identities, a total of 93% reporting experiencing legal problems, over 20% reporting police harassment. And this was 2 years ago. This is before we're seeing an even stronger mainstream push.
Yeah, and that report was finished in 2022, but I think I would guesstimate that it's worse now. But this current study was, we did not do like a survey. What we did was a qualitative study, which means interviewing people. So it was 22 people that we interviewed who had experienced anti-trans attacks, either as trans activists or as members of trans serving organizations. So there's that. And we also did a media scan, and we did a review of academic literature and literature from various organizations across the country.
Okay. And are there any results that you can share pre-publication with me about, you know, some of the highlights that you found?
Absolutely. So the main sections of the report are to basically identify what the anti-trans movement is, who's involved, why this movement has risen, what this movement is saying about trans folks and saying about like kind of their own justifications for being involved and what they're doing. So that's the first section. And then there's another section about effects on individuals, organizations, and community. And the last section is kind of how our interviewees and the broader community are responding and fighting back. So I can say quickly, I think what's important to know is the main tactics that the movement, the anti-trans movement, is using are to use social media and traditional media, especially to promote disinformation, which means intentionally spreading wrong information. They're also kind of banning and limiting accurate information getting spread, for instance, by doing book bans in schools and banning sex ed. Another big tactic is institutional tactics. So it's either individual people kind of using institutional channels to do harm, for instance, with petitions or like flooding elected officials with emails. It's also big and small institutions pulling their weight. So like I mentioned earlier, governments fully enacting anti-trans laws, as well as funding trans-exclusionary radical feminist orgs. So orgs that that believe trans women aren't women and that believe trans women are dangerous to cis women and girls. The other big tactic is protests, and the last one is violence. So that included anything from vandalism and kind of verbal harassment type of things to threats, physical harassment and stalking, assault and murder. So murder was actually something that came out of a study that we found. This study is from the US, and what the researchers found is that since 2015, I believe, there's been an increase in anti-trans rhetoric and laws, and that is correlated with the increase in murders of trans people in the US. So it's extremely concerning seeing how saying hateful things and doing hateful things is correlated with extreme violence.
And all very important ways to recognize the way that this kind of hate is spread, I think, because understanding where it's coming from means that we can hopefully, and the goal is, I guess, to organize ourselves to make sure that we can address these issues and these areas that the harmful and hateful rhetoric and beliefs are coming from, because this is obviously a very serious issue that we need to work hard to resolve. So
yeah,
knowing where it's coming from is going to be very important going forward.
And what came, sorry, I wanted to get into how the community is responding, basically, and how the way that came up in the interviews and through the media scan. So the main message is to keep fighting the good fight. Don't back down, even if you get attacked. Pretty much everyone we interviewed said, like, I'm not stopping, we're continuing, we're keeping up our activities and events and organizing. Anti-trans tactics are getting mirrored by the community. So the anti-trans movement is promoting disinformation while we're countering that disinformation with, like, whether that's infographics or teach-ins or social media posts. We're also using our own institutional tactics and counter-protesting. It was also really important to interview that allies show up. So the trans community cannot do this work on our own. We need to have our allies show up, whether that's in the broader queer community or in leftist spaces, anti-racist and decolonial spaces, and feminist spaces. So one thing to know about the anti-trans movement is that all the various groups that are kind of forming a coalition to be part of the anti-trans movement, they all hate each other for various reasons. So I think it's a key way that we can destabilize them by, like, reminding them that they hate each other, whereas our own coalitions with allies are based in having a same basic value of, we're doing this work to protect marginalized communities and improve the material conditions of marginalized communities. So I think we have a strength in this that we can leverage. And another really important result that we found was that the importance of divesting from police in responding to the anti-trans movement. So interviewees spoke to police either not being helpful or outright being unsafe. The police is more likely to harm two-spirit, trans, non-binary, and gender diverse individuals than to help out. And this is, from prior research, we know that this is especially the case for racialized folks and sex workers in the community. So that means that organizations need to revise their policies so they don't call the cops when something happens. I think it's something that's better known within the community, but sometimes trans-serving organizations don't know this. It might be because their primary focus is not serving trans folks, but other things. So that's a really important thing to know, and to invest in alternatives to police, whether that's having de-escalation training or doing mutual aid and community care or screening locations for events, documenting and tracking bad actors by ourselves within the community. We do not need police to keep us safe because they are actively harming us.
That's what the community is for, right? We're here to support each other and build each other up, because historically, there haven't been anybody else to do that for us. And so
exactly,
we have to take that stance
exactly.
Ourselves. I say we just because I'm queer too. So, you know.
Well, that I mean, that means you probably know that the police has never been safe to queer people. So this is more of the same as has always been the case.
Mm-hmm. I feel like people are becoming more and more educated about the impact that the police has and the harm that they that it causes as an institution, and that the understanding is growing also that we're not just talking about, people love to say a few bad apples, but we're talking about a system that is based in settler colonial violence, that is based in, it is built to break people down, versus if communities were invest, if cities and provinces and the federal government were investing in social services to help build communities up, you know, that bottom-up approach is so important, I think, to making sure that we're taking care of people and doing it in a way that we're also listening to people and listening to their needs to make sure that we can respond to them in the way that they want, which is super important. I'll circle back to the main report and the event on the 25th. So what are your main hopes for the day? How do you think people are going to react to this report, the information, and everything that you have planned?
I'm just hoping the event goes smoothly. I think there's so many moving parts. I hope people appreciate it. There will be a feedback survey, so I hope that will also give people the chance to say how they felt about the event and whether they thought it was helpful. Last I checked, we did have over 70 people registered for the event, so I hope that we'll get a lot of attendees, but otherwise it will be recorded and eventually the video will go up online as well. So if you can't make it, don't worry about it. That information will all be available. And I would really encourage people to either look at the, once it's online, the presentation, like PowerPoint, or the full 20-page report for ideas of preventative measures and like safety measures, because there are so many that I couldn't even recite them all. I had to cut some of them from the PowerPoint too, but they will be in the final guide. So if you're wondering like, okay, how can I protect myself? There's so many tips that interviewees identified that are really helpful.
So in a few months, listeners and anybody who's interested in educating themselves can go find that report on Justice Trans website. Alexis, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate all of your insight and you being open to having this conversation about some tough topics.
Thank you very much for reaching out.
Was Alexis, the former research director at Justice Trans, and Madison Edward Wright in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Maddie and Alexis. For more information on Justice Trans, check them out online at justicetrans.org. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It, and for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In labor news, Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow Madison Edward Wright took a deep dive into the conditions for support workers on university campuses. Her long-form essay on Rabble.ca chronicles the growing struggle that teaching assistants, library assistants, food service workers, and other university support staff face for better wages and working conditions. In many of these cases, universities have strongly opposed their efforts to unionize and push back on their demands. These efforts have even included allegations of intimidation. Read this thorough investigation into the labor struggles on university campuses on Rabble.ca today. Staying in labor news, teachers in Saskatchewan continue to fight the conservative government of Premier Scott Moe for better wages and conditions. Teachers staged a walkout on March 20th, the day that Moe announced his annual budget, which continued to fail to address their concerns about wages and class size. Teachers have increasingly been joined by students who have been supporting their strike actions. One student told Rabble that the actions of Scott Moe and his refusal to bargain in good faith shows what he and his government really thinks of students. In Ontario news, public unions in the province are slamming the Doug Ford government after they presented their own annual budget this week. While both healthcare and education received an increase in funding from last year, those increases are below the rate of inflation, effectively meaning a cut to public spending in terms of real dollars. This was the case for many public services in Ontario that people rely on during these tough economic times. Ontario Federation of Labour President Laura Walton slammed the budget, saying, quote, "This budget will make life harder and more expensive for the people of Ontario. When you don't fund the services people need, it forces them to pay out of pocket and makes the cost of living crisis worse for workers and their families," end quote. In BC News, proposed changes to the BC Labour Code means that unionized workers in the province will no longer be required to cross any picket lines. Prior to this change, provincially unionized workers would still be required to cross a picket line if those striking were federally unionized or unionized in another province. Rabble Labour columnist Tom Sanborn said that this change is significant and will no longer divide workers based on their union of origin, giving those workers more leverage when negotiating with their employer. In the arts, a film being featured at the Hot Docs Film Festival in Toronto is shining a light on the working and living conditions in private long-term care facilities. Stolen Time is writer-director Helene Klodowski's compelling documentary that follows personal injury lawyer Melissa Miller as she takes on the corporate for-profit nursing home industry notorious for its lack of transparency and accountability. Rabble contributor Doreen Nichols' full review of this film is on rabble.ca today. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is reminding everyone of the importance of ice, snow, and glaciers to the ecosystem. The majority of the world's fresh water is frozen in glaciers, but those glaciers are rapidly melting thanks to climate change. Glaciers also reflect more solar radiation back into space, therefore helping to fight climate change. The importance of water, ice, snow, and glaciers must be understood as an important part of the fight against the climate crisis. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Radio Rewind.